Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 250, recorded for the week of March 6th, 2024. The Cloud Pod goes nuclear powered. Good evening, Matt. How's it going?
Hey, good evening, Justin.
Yeah, you know, we're just talking last week with Ryan that we need to get everyone aligned back to dates so we can get everyone back on the show. And then we failed this week. So we can call ourselves out for our own failure. But we at least we're recording. So that's always a win. But we are trying to get everyone shepherded into the same day, but it hasn't worked out yet for whatever reason.
Yeah, it turns out two time zones, four family schedules is very difficult to coordinate along with many kids.
Yeah, I blame all the young kids. I'm always the easy one. I'm like, yeah, I can record any of those days. And you guys are all like, yeah, I can't do this day and I can't do that day. And I'm like, okay.
No, you guys were young enough where I can do most days.
You're good right now, but you'll get a point where it won't be so great.
But, that's true.
You're a little ways away from that. But,
yeah, mine's good. Only two, so we're good.
Yeah. Well, our first news story is about you, Matt.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So apparently you're doing a talk somewhere. So maybe you want to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm doing a talk at the Camp IT conference in Chicago about IT infrastructure operations and cloud strategies. To be honest, I'm still figuring out exactly what I'm talking about, but it's going to be a combination of our product and the different technologies that we use to actually build it. So when I figure it out, I will let you all know. But if you're in the Chicago area, let me know and I will make sure I force Justin to mail me some stickers so that if you see me at the conference, tell me, I'll provide you some stickers.
Assuming that I deliver on the stickers, but
I'm just going to keep harassing you about it. Yeah, we'll put a Slack bot reminder for like every day till you do it. One of the two.
Yeah, someone just ordered stickers the other day and I have yet to get them to him. I need to do that. But he happens to be doing some contracting work for the day job. So he's a little more tolerant than most people would be. But if, you know, most other listeners would get their stickers right away. But actually, I was going to the post office tomorrow anyways. It's on my address. I even have it in my calendar because that's been my blocker for maybe being able to actually go has been finding the time in my busy schedule to go. So I have it in my calendar. Go to post office.
I do that.
So I will also send out yours as well. And then we'll be good. So yeah, you'll have stickers for your event in Chicago. That sounds fun. I love the title of your talk, Using Data and AI to Shine a Light on Your Dark IT Estate. Which,
yeah,
you know, sounds very Star Wars-y. Like, ooh.
It's one of our marketing themes is enlightening your darkest state. So, you know, our product collects a bunch of telemetry data. So it's understanding all your end users, you know, what's going on in your end users' computers to get the telemetry back to see and help them figure out what's going on.
Nice. I do love your last sentence here is AI transformations, because of course you had to throw AI in there, didn't you?
There's no AI. It's like there was a toothbrush that came out with AI. Still trying to figure out how your toothbrush has AI, but if there's no AI, it must be garbage at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Just looking at the rest of the speakers, so lots of other good talks too. So it looks like a good fun day. These are great. It's funny because I really love the C2C event. And I've gotten so many connections from the C2C event, you know, people pinging me on LinkedIn. And then even, you know, people pinging me like, hey, I saw you at C2C. And then I checked out the show. And so, you know, we have a bunch of new listeners from C2C as well. So those people are all welcome to be here. So thanks for coming back and wanting to hear me drone on again. So I guess it's worthwhile.
Well, I hope to do it half as good as you did. And if we get half the number of extra listeners, I call it a win.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. All right. Well, let's get to news because they don't care about us talking about our speaking engagements. But AI is going great, or as Ryan likes to say, AI is how ML makes money segment. Anthropic is in the news this week as their new model is apparently beating GPT-4. The newest edition of Claude 3 is their latest rival to OpenAI's GPT-4. It comes in three flavors, which I love that they're naming them instead of like weird names. Claude 3 Haiku, Claude 3 Sonnet, and Claude 3 Opus. Opus, of course, being the most powerful one. They all show increased capabilities, analysis, and forecasting, and Anthropic claims as well as enhanced performance on specific benchmarks versus models like GPT-4. But they do caveat not GPT-4 Turbo. And they do say it beats Google Gemini 1.0 Ultra, but not Gemini 1.5 Pro, which, you know, for a vendor press release to admit where they're weaker, you know, I applaud your honesty. So that's really nice. Claude 3 is Anthropic's first full multimodal model. which means it can do all kinds of different things from text and video analysis. And one of the cool things about their model that others can't do is they can analyze multiple images in a single request, up to 20 of them. So you can do comparisons of different images. And so, you know, that's kind of cool. They do say there are some limitations of that capability. It can't really identify people, as they're not allowing it to. And then also, it's prone to mistakes on low quality images under 200 pixels. So, my dream of being able to do enhance is not quite here yet with this particular model. but maybe in the future we'll be able to get that, capability as well. But, you know, I was thinking about some really cool use cases for this, because you can do 20, you know, 20 images compares. If you think about like generating images out of your QA process where you're like validating website, you know, you could use that to then do comparisons of like, hey, what's different between these two images? And, oh, you know, this image moved to the right is what it was supposed to. Yeah, you can do some really cool QA automation with some of that kind of stuff. So overall, this looks like not a bad model. I did see a little bit of chatter today, actually. You know, some people saying it's not quite as good in some areas, but it's pretty good in others. And it is not connected to the internet, this model. So it is dated only through August of 2023. So anything that happened after that, like the Israeli Hamas conflicts, you know, it doesn't know anything about those. So just be aware.
You know, it's actually interesting now. There's so many models out there. You know, you have to start to look at what makes sense for your data and what you need, along with, you know, also price. You know, I look too much closely at what the price is, but you might be able to get away with running this over GPT-4 Turbo, and you might not need the latest and greatest. And you're leveraging this in what, you know, your company's product, or just in general playing with it on the side. You might want to look at some of these pricing and kind of do a quick, you know, back of the napkin math of like, okay, if we need this many requests with this many tokens, kind of where it all lines out, because this model looks pretty good on many different fronts. There's a few places it's not, but you know, it has its place.
Yeah, that's very true. Because you know, the ability to cut, you know, to make determinations on most recent news is sort of one of those things that, you know, not everybody needs. If I'm building models around, you know, document summarization, I don't necessarily need a bunch of new data. I just need to be able to summarize a document, which is using English skills. So, you know, you can use a much lesser model for that type of work versus one that needs to be able to build something off of modern events. So again, think about your use case and think about as you walk through those processes. Meta actually published a paper this week about their LLM-based test generator, which I found fascinating. I was not able to actually go read the white paper itself because it is behind a paywall, and you know, I don't want to go pay for a research paper. But there was a great summarization from the Engineers Codex blog, which I'm a subscriber to, and the post, you know, is basically about this paper called "Automated Unit Test Improvements Using the LLM at Meta." And the idea they have is to basically use AI to make developers more productive from Google using AI for code reviews. And basically the goal of AI is that it recommends fully formed software improvements that are verified to be both correct and an improvement on current code coverage tests. Compared to ChatGPT, where things have to be manually verified to work, it's a nice improvement, as this is workable code from what they're saying in their paper. The TestGen LLM uses an approach called Assured LLM based software engineering. It uses private internal LLMs that are probably fine-tuned with Meta's code base. And this means it uses LLM to generate improvements that are backed by verifiable guarantees of improvement and non-regression. TestGen LLM uses an ensemble approach to generate the code improvement. And a good way to think about this is like a junior developer with the task of creating more comprehensive tests of your existing code, with other devs having more important things to work on. So this LLM can take the fun task of improving your unit tests. And basically they said that in their results, it produced a really good, or uncovers a bug in the code that they had it test out with. You know, this is all great work that needs to be done by someone, not necessarily humans. And if you have a human reviewer just reviewing the pull request, they can either reject the dumb tests, or they might be able to find some really cool code tests. Interesting enough, I was curious about this, if it's something I could do today. And this code is available. Test LLM is out there. You can go find several GitHub repos where you can get it. I think you do have to train a model with your code to make it really worthwhile. But you know, the technology is out there. You can kind of build something very similar to what Meta's done here. And start getting some better unit test coverage in your product.
No, it's amazing where we're going with all this stuff. And the fact that it's able to actually like take your own, do the analysis and produce anything, you know, is great. Unit tests are one of those things that if you're not doing test-driven development, which I feel like very few people do, TDD, you know, it's a great way to start to really find all these bugs. Slightly terrifying on the same level of how good it gets at some of these things, you know, as I play with Copilot and a few of the other you know, technologies that I play with often, but it's getting there and, you know, it can start to automate some of these things, which is great. Because let's be honest, what developer really likes to write unit tests?
I know I was never good at it because I was always too focused on writing the code. Cause that's the fun part. Right. Writing the tests and TDD and all that, I get the power of it. It was always the part that I sucked at the most. So if I can get someone to help me write the better tests, that's good. And then, you know, think about legacy code bases, you know, right. 5, 10, 15 years before even, you know, test-driven development was even a thing. You know, a lot of those applications lack really good unit tests. So if you can take this and you can actually start building unit tests that make sense for your product, you can really get a lot of good code coverage very quickly with using a tool, something like this. Well, Ryan and I last week were talking about how difficult it is to pick a LLM. And you actually just mentioned it as well when we were talking about GPT-4 and some of the choices. And so I happened to stumble across this post by Cohere about picking the right AI model. Now, I'm going to guess they might have some biases because they do have their own model. But they do actually call it out in one of their parts of the article. They say, you know, we think we have a pretty good one. And so that's, you know, what this paper basically walks you through is how to choose the right AI model for your enterprise. And some of the advice that they basically say you should think about is the model open source or proprietary? And consider not only the upfront cost of the model, but also the time to solution, data provenance, and indemnity options to avoid any unwanted surprises like indemnity obligations some open source providers include. Then review the level of support and engineering know-how you will need and the frequency of updates made to the models. Again, this is the relevancy of the model to your use case. There's general or tailored models, and right-sizing the model to your use case and performance requirement at scale is critical. For example, does your solution need advanced reasoning and the cost that it requires to do advanced reasoning for every query? Or consider how a fine-tuned model with advanced RAG capabilities may outperform a large general model at the fraction of the cost. Look for models optimized for performance with methods like quantization, transformer efficiencies, and model compression techniques. And the last advice is transformation or incremental adoption. With most organizations starting with solutions for tactical benefits like increasing productivity and lowering costs, but a growing trend among customers is improving information retrieval systems with a simple integration of a re-rank solution, something to think about in your model stuff. So I'm going to keep an eye on this one because I still think this is just a good tip of the iceberg or what you need to think about in these models, but I appreciate that they're trying to give you advice on how to think about it.
I mean, to me, this is no different than anytime you grab a new piece of technology, you're throwing it in, you know. I've always said use the right tool in the right place at the right time. So, you know, you're trying to write something that's going to run on Windows, don't grab a PowerShell. Don't grab Python. Grab something that runs a PowerShell so you know it works. But, you know, kind of working through the options as you should with any new library or tool, you know, make sure, especially the libraries, you know, and the licensing is always kind of something you need to, like, really make sure of because you need to include it or not include it, you know, and depending on for your work, you know, if any of those things matter. But yeah, no, I think that this is going to be an area, especially as we explode with the number of models before we kind of reconsolidate down into like the top 10 or so that people end up using on a daily basis. You know, I feel like this is, we're at that growth period where this is going to become much more important.
Yeah. I'm sort of hoping for a Forrester wave or a magic quadrant of models. You know, some kind of like general guidance that would be helpful as well. But, you know, I assume it's going to be an area that's rapidly maturing here over the next few years as people get more experience and more use cases behind these things.
Both excited for gardeners to do that and mad that they're going to do it because it's going to be behind a paywall. Just saying.
Yes. And it's an expensive paywall. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to AWS. First up, we can say Feliz Claridad today as a new Mexico region is coming to the central region, and this will be the second Latin American region joining the Sao Paulo region. And this new region will have 3 availability zones, which is great. Glad to have a second choice in South America, as it was a little bit of a problem when you wanted to do DR, unless you wanted to DR to America or Canada. So good to have a secondary region in the time zone. And then it says we're on new regions. Let's also talk about the new region in Kingdom of Saudi Arabia that'll be coming in 2026. AWS has announced this new region is an investment of $5.3 billion in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which will allow their customers to keep their content in the country as required by their data sovereignty laws. This region will also have 3 availability zones. But again, the problem with this region is going to be DR. Where do you DR? But hey, Google's got a region there too, so you can just go multi-cloud and DR between the two, unless they're next to each other, which time will tell where they're both going to be built out at.
I mean, the odds are, I feel like they're going to be in a shared data center that they both rent space in, but that's just
next to the truck that runs the Oracle data center.
And the Azure data center, so it's fine. No big deal.
Exactly.
No, I think the Mexico one's interesting because, you know, San Paulo has been around weeks since I've been using AWS. So
yeah, it's a really old region.
10 years, you know, 10 plus years it's been around. So, you know, that's for just launching a new one in South America, feels shocking that there wasn't one. And it's just an area of the world I never, you know, have really focused on for cloud. I feel like I've dealt with more with Australia and UK and Germany and all the other fun, mainly due to like GDPR and other compliance regulations. So I think your DR for Saudi Arabia is UAE, or is that just...
I mean, yes, ideally you would, UAE for AWS. But the problem is the KSA regulations for data sovereignty say it has to stay in Saudi Arabia. They won't even support UAE. So it's really a problem of what is Saudi Arabia supporting in their data sovereignty law. But that's where the problem is. But it's interesting now because I think, everyone was kind of saying it was just going to be GCP and Oracle, but now having AWS come into the region too gives a lot more opportunity for companies. Real time follow up on Sao Paulo though. 2011, December 14th, 2011.
So that had to be in their first couple regions though.
Yeah, it's definitely very, very early. I don't know, 8 regions at that time. So yeah. It's come a long way.
The problem now is I sit here and go, okay, let's see what I can remember each of the regions. GovCloud was launched in 2011. Didn't know that.
I don't think I could have picked that. You know, it's interesting because if you looked at any of the new FedRAMP regulations, they're actually saying that the whole isolated GovCloud thing is counterproductive to what they wanted FedRAMP to do. And so their new draft regulations for FedRAMP are actually trying to change it so they don't want to have dedicated GovClouds anymore.
Ooh, that'll be nice.
Yeah. So that's
for my day job, we've talked about, customers have asked us for FedRAMP, but I'm like, I don't want to deal with a full other Azure. It has to be a full other Azure tenant and all of the shared infrastructure and everything else. So I've avoided all of that as long as I could.
Yeah. So they're pointing to Google's model as being their preferred model where, you know, you can basically set up a project as a specific sovereignty. And that one will then basically prevent, you know, we give it all the controls they want and provide the right level of access, which is interesting because, yeah, on GCP, you can get up to DoD IL5 support if you want to, as well as FedRAMP moderate and FedRAMP high. So, quite interesting.
I mean, AWS, you can go all the way up on there.
Yeah, you can go all the way up to top secret with AWS, but that's all in top secret zones and that kind of stuff.
I mean, my favorite announcement ever was AWS announces a new... And not top secret. Top secret region.
Yeah. That not very like, secretive.
I feel like you're failing at the secret part of that statement. It's just me.
Yeah. I actually think, we talked about that here on the show. I was just trying to see if I could see when we did that.
Don't worry. I've been sitting here going through the AWS page, seeing when all the regions were launched that were prior to that one. It's like Singapore, Tokyo, which I knew. China has been around forever, which I knew. Africa was later on. I remember that was a big deal because it was the first cloud provider in Africa, in South Africa, which still means the whole rest of the continent still doesn't have any. But Ireland, I didn't realize that was 2007.
Yeah, that was a really early one.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that early though.
I think that was the first European one actually.
Yeah,
if I'm correct,
it was US Yolo 1, so US East 1 in 2020.
When was US West 1 opened? Because I feel like that one opened early, but then nothing happened to it.
2009. But the reason nothing happened to it is because it cost them too much to run.
Yeah, it was outrageously expensive.
Pivoted over. I assume they did it in, you know, to be close for all the tech companies around there.
Yep.
And then they were like, wait, we don't actually care about that. We need to actually be able to support a lot more than what the Equinix data centers can actually give us.
Yeah, well, and I think the price delta between all the other regions and that region was also a big detractor because everyone was looking at, why would I go there when I can go to Virginia?
It's still 10 to 20% more. I mean, I've done
it's still
3 or 4 migrations, I feel like back in the day from US East 1 to US East 2 purely for the cost savings. Even with the cross-region data transfer fees and everything else, paid for itself in like 2 months. And US West 1 used to have a ton of capacity issues.
Yes, it did. And I think it still does. It doesn't have a lot of the newer instance types.
Yeah.
And it has missing with some other things as well. So, well, an interesting purchase happened. Talon Energy Corp, which is not a cloud provider, has sold its Cumulus data center campus near a Pennsylvania nuclear power station to AWS. It's a 960 megawatt data center campus that can house multiple data center facilities, all powered by the Susquehanna nuclear power plant. The data center campus comprises 1,200 acres, and AWS has a minimum contractual power commitment for the data center that will ramp up to 120 megawatts increments over several years with a one-time option to cap commitments at 480 megawatts. Now, the interesting thing about this, I was like, well, it's a little bit, I thought maybe it was close enough on the Pennsylvania border to North Virginia that it wouldn't be a big deal, but it's actually like 300 miles or so. It's 200 or 300 miles. It's not close. So I was trying to figure out if this is going to be a new U.S. East region, or is this going to be somehow extended to U.S. East 1? So I'm not exactly sure how Amazon's planning to use this thing, because they haven't announced it. And all this news comes from directly from Talon Energy, who publicly had to announce it because they're a publicly traded company. They signed a big material commitment like this, but pretty interesting. Apparently, this Cumulus data center campus also has a crypto data center that Talon owns on the property. So I wonder if they were thinking that crypto would be a lot bigger than it was, and then didn't quite work out the way they hoped it would.
I mean, it's up to 60,000. Bitcoin's over 60. There was like 65 a couple days ago. So
yeah, I mean, it goes up and down all the time. It's just it's very unstable. That's the problem with crypto.
Yeah. No, I was looking up when I read this article for the first time. I was like, oh yeah, the Voyager 1 just died, and how many megawatts in comparison? It was like, this is thousands of times more.
If you have a solar powered calculator on your desk, it probably has more compute power than Voyager 1 did. So I was reading that too. That was kind of a sad day that Voyager 1 might be dead. So
yeah, I thought they decided it was at this point.
I just read an article about it Tuesday, and they were saying they didn't have a lot of hope for it, but they were trying a bunch of things and they weren't giving up yet. But it takes a day to send a message to and a day to get a message back. If the hardware is failing, there's nothing they can do. But
I complain about 15 minute iteration times of waiting for a server to boot up.
Yeah, exactly.
Your iteration time is in the days,
Indeed. All right. Well, if you're an EKS customer and you've been waiting anxiously to get on to that AL 2023 goodness, EKS now officially supports the AL 2023 or Amazon Linux 2023 images. The next generation of Amazon Linux from AWS is designed to provide a secure, stable, and high-performance environment to develop and run your cloud applications. EKS customers can enjoy the benefit of Amazon Linux 2023 by using standard AL 2023-based EKS optimized image AMIs with managed node groups, self-managed nodes, and Carpenter. Several improvements over AL2 that include a secure by default approach to help improve your security posture with pre-configured security policies, SE Linux and permissive mode, and IMSD v2 enabled by default, as well as optimized boot time to reduce the time from instance launch to running applications. And I was just curious, ECS got their optimized AL2023 Linux in March of 2023, so almost a year ago. I'm surprised how long this one took.
That's what I thought. I was like looking up to see, I was like, did I miss something? Because I feel like AL2 became what's originally like, was supposed to be Amazon Linux 2022, which got renamed to 2023, I thought. And this just feels like a really long time for them to get support. So either it wasn't a priority, which sounds weird because, I thought they were trying to kill off AL2. They had to do a whole lot to make it get there. Like, I'm just trying to figure out why it took them so long.
Yeah, and Amazon Linux 2 end of life is was extended from June 2023 to June 2025. So they have just over 18 months really to get there. So they had to get to 2023. But I'm still hoping. I'm selfishly hoping they abandon AL 2023, which is based on Fedora, and pivot over to Rocky Linux. That's just my personal hope, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
Rocky Linux, it's based on Red Hat, so it's still RPM. right?
Yeah. So basically, Rocky Linux is basically the new version of CentOS, basically.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. But they divorced themselves from a lot of the Red Hat upstream stuff. So they actually aren't dependent on the Red Hat upstream as much as anymore. They used to be. Yeah.
See, I've always been a Ubuntu shop because that's what I learned Linux on at, because my university, Northeastern, was a DistroPoint.
Interesting. I've always been an Ubuntu user at home. So I'm a big Ubuntu user in all my home stuff. But at work, it's always been Red Hat or CentOS. So my current day job is Ubuntu, which is my first Ubuntu enterprise company. So
we were having a conversation. We were rebuilding a couple of our build servers and we were debating whether we stick to what we had or Ubuntu. And I was like, I prefer Ubuntu because one, I know it better just because that's what I've used more. But, you know, it just seems to work, which is bravo to them. Yeah. Oh, I don't know why I've always preferred it. I assume it's because that's what I learned. Well, I guess I learned Linux and Solaris, but then really Ubuntu, it's barely where I learned it. So the old Solaris.
So we talked earlier in the show about Anthropic Claude 3 Sonnet, and that's now available to you on Amazon on Bedrock. Sonnet today with Opus and Haiku coming very soon. Amazon points out that Claude 3 Sonnet is 2x faster than Claude 2 and Claude 2.1 with increased durability and new image text vision capabilities. Claude 3 has also expanded languages understanding beyond English to also include French, Japanese, and Spanish, which these are things I'm like, why wasn't that in the Anthropic announcement? But, you know, here we are. Nirav Kingsland, head of global accounts at Anthropic, said, Anthropic at its core is a research company that is trying to create the safest and large language models in the world. And through Amazon Bedrock, we have a chance to take the technology, distribute it to users globally, and do this in an extremely safe and data secure manner. So if you were excited about Claude 3 earlier, you can use it on Bedrock.
Yay.
Yeah. Last week, Amazon was really excited because they announced to us that Mistral AI was coming to Bedrock.
And drumroll, please.
And a week later, they're back telling us it's here. And I have to say, Amazon, this just looks desperate. Couldn't have waited a week. Couldn't have just, you know, hey, it's now available today. You know, you didn't have to tell me pre-announcement last week. I mean, it's one thing to pre-announce and like it takes a month or so, but like literally you pre-announced, we recorded, and like 3 days later you announced it was available. It just smells of desperation. And this is where I was commenting earlier about weird named models. Like, unlike Opus, Haiku, and Sonnet, Mistral 7B and Mistral 8X7B are the two that are available on Bedrock.
Just every time I see this, I see Mistress. Mistress 7B, and I'm like, all right, that's a funny name for Mistress, but that's fine.
It's very French of it. It seems very aligned. So this is a French-based model.
My theory is that Bedrock has to have X number of announcements to hit their quota. As their AI service, so that was their way to hit the quota for the week.
They were short for the week. They needed something, and they're like, "Well, it's coming. We can talk about it. We just can't announce it yet."
So, and it's within the 30 days, so it's near term, not short term, which is 3 to 6 months out. Mm-hmm. It's not long term of 9+. So
fair enough. Well, if you're a WAF user, an Amazon WAF user, you may be familiar with the really bad dashboards that it comes with. And really bad is kind of the understatement of the century. They're almost impossible to use. However, this week, Amazon's giving me presents with a new WAF overview dashboard to make it easy to see your security-focused metrics so that you can identify and take action on security risks in a few clicks, such as adding rate-based rules during distributed DDoS events. And the dashboard includes near real-time summaries of Amazon CloudWatch metrics that the WAF collects. These dashboards are available by default and require you to do nothing. And with the default metrics, such as total number of requests, blocked requests, and common attacks blocked, you can customize your dashboard with the metrics and visualizations that are most important to you. And as soon as I read through this and wrote it in the show notes, I then rushed over to my account where I started playing with it. And oh my God, it's so much better. So A+ for improving that horribleness that was the old dashboard.
Yeah, that old dashboard was rough. It reminds me of almost like the Macy like 1.0 of it, where it just felt like they threw something at the last second to hit, hey, we have to do this in order to get that done, so like, let's get something there. I'm just surprised how long it lived.
I mean, I don't really know how, I mean, the WAF has gotten some more love, and let's say in the last 12 months, but it doesn't feel like it's more than one Pizza Box team. So it's something they care about enough to keep innovating on it, but not enough to really innovate on it.
Well, the problem is to do a WAF, I was talking with my security guy the other day, and he's like, big WAF companies, Impreza, Akamai, those, you know, they've teamed to people. They perpetually are watching and updating and tweaking and whatnot. And I feel like this isn't a check the box. It can definitely do more than that. But, you know, it's, you know, build your own WAF. You know, it's building your own, which is what AWS is known for. So you can customize it and make it really work well. You just have to spend the time and put the effort in, or you buy a tool that does, you know, 90% out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the build it, you buy it method.
Or what you can do is what I did, just put the Cloud Pod website behind Cloudflare, enable their WAF and DDoS capabilities, and you're done. I won't think about it ever now. And so it's a pretty nice package over there. So I definitely recommend, if you're not interested in implementing the Amazon WAF, or you're looking for something that's maybe multi-cloud, Cloudflare would be your friend.
And their free version is pretty
darn good. Yeah. I do pay for the $29 level because I wanted some of those features, but I honestly didn't have to, but I wanted to play with it more than I had in the past. And so it was good to get the extra capabilities. It's a little, although I did recently have an SSL certificate expire on the CloudPod website because I hadn't retired the Route 53 zone for the CloudPod because I'd moved it all to Cloudflare, of course, because it's easier if you manage it in Cloudflare. And so it was trying to do the DNS ACM certificate validation against Route 53 because that's where I put the records. And I'm like, why isn't this working? Why isn't it validating? And then when it finally, like, you know, weeks and months of like, you know, it's going to expire any day. And I'm like, yeah, I already did the validation. Like, it's Amazon's problem. And it finally expired. And I was like, I had this epiphany as I was like, why is this not working? I was like, oh, because it's in Cloudflare. So I had to terminate the certificate and create a new one because I let it expire. But I did fix that issue now. But you remember that if you do pivot over.
It's still the great thing about ACM is it just works normally.
It just works, yeah.
If you follow the basics, it just works. I miss ACM.
I will say the logs and errors were not as helpful as they could have been. I mean, like, yes, telling me that the record isn't there and then automatically, hey, we want to create the record and it goes to Route 53. Like, it, you know, if you looked at you also have my registration Google, Amazon. So if you looked at my registration, you saw that I wasn't actually using the Route 53 DNS. You could have given me something error.
Well, good news, if you delete that Route 53 zone now, you save 50 cents a month.
That's correct. I did delete it and I did see a reduction. So yes, pennies are being saved.
A whole $6 a year. You might be able to buy a beer
Starbucks. In places. Well, at least a tall Starbucks, not a tall one. Or Grande, but. All right. Amazon sees you, Google, and calls your bluff with their own free data transfer out capability when moving out of AWS. AWS feels they're the best choice for a broad set of services, including over 200 fully featured services for all your workload needs. But starting today, AWS now believes this voice must include the one to migrate your data to another cloud provider or on-premise. And so now they are waiving data transfer out to the internet, or as they call DTO, chargers when you want to move outside of AWS. They point out that over 90% of their customers already incur no data transfer expenses out of AWS because they provide 100 gigabytes per month free from AWS regions to the internet. But if you need more, it's as simple as reaching out to your AWS support to ask for free DTO rates for the additional data. And AWS says you must go through support because customers make hundreds of millions of data transfers each day, and they do not know if the data transferred out of the internet is normal or part of your business or a one-time transfer as part of a switch to another cloud provider on-premise. All review requests will be done at the AWS account level. And once approved, they will be provided credits for the data being migrated. You know, in their initial article, they said they don't require you to close the account. But if you read the FAQ, it does say that you have a 60-day period that you can delete the remaining data or close your account. So if you move the data out, you can't leave it in AWS after that. You have to delete it or delete the account altogether. You know, they say they believe in customer choice. And the waiver on the data transfer, though, also follows the directive set by the European Data Act, which it makes me now realize that both Google and Amazon aren't just doing this out of the niceness of their hearts. They are doing it due to EU regulation. So we do expect Azure to follow suit as well. But, you know, it's sort of like the DMA stuff that Apple's doing. Like, yeah, technically you can write your own third-party app store, but we're still going to make your life hell if you do that and still require you to pay us a ton of money because we're Apple. And sort of the same thing I feel about these data transfer out clauses as well.
Now I'm wondering, what if you decide, this is actually like a pretty potential, you've run into this, Josh, I'm sure, I need to move from one AWS account to another.
Mm-hmm.
It just says move out versus trying to set up peering or anything else and connect to your normal network. You could, in theory, say you're transferring out, route from one AWS account to another. It is out of that AWS account. That would solve your migration strategy from one AWS account to another for like S3 buckets, stuff like that.
Yeah. See, I was trying to figure out, like, could I create an account and do all my egress traffic from that account? You know, but I think my cross account charges would probably negate any savings I would have gotten and just keep, you know, canceling that account and moving to the next one. But I'm sure, you know, give it time, people will come up with something clever.
It wouldn't, because normally like cross account is like 2 cents a gig, but egress out is like 9 cents a gig, I thought.
True. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm saving some, but.
I mean, if you're talking hundreds of gigs, yeah, it's up quickly.
Yeah, it does add up quickly. I did like the idea that they start out this article with, hey, 90% of our customers don't incur any fee because of the free tier. But then they go, but we have hundreds of millions of transactions per day in DTO that we don't know what they are. I'm like, those two numbers don't really jive.
How many AWS accounts have you set up that just sat there for a long time?
A lot. I mean, that was how I said the same thing in the FinOps Slack, and someone was like, well, I've never been in a company where we've had that much data transfer out. I was like, okay. And then, yeah, a bunch of people were like, yeah, I have a bunch of accounts that just sit there doing nothing. I'm like, yeah, I guess if you average out all the accounts in the world, there are probably a lot of accounts doing absolutely no data transfer out.
It's like NAT gateways.
Yeah.
That's how Amazon makes money. It's fine. We've all just accepted it.
Yeah. So I mean, they sort of in reverse just told us that, you know, only 10% of their accounts actually use Amazon Web Services. it's all right.
Well, they say the cloud pod, how much data transfer out do you have in there?
Not very much.
Right. So you're probably in that below 100 gigs.
Yes, I am. But, you know, I have worked at companies where out was a lot of our data and it was very expensive. So, yes, you're a bit of an outlier, I suspect, which is why, you know, that's the scenario where if your DTO is really high, Oracle is your friend. Oracle Cloud Zoom has much better prices.
There you go. Welcome to Zoom.
Welcome to Zoom. All right. Hey, guess what? Google got a new model. Could you guess which new model it might be?
ChatGPT.
No one's getting ChatGPT but Azure. Azure has that locked down with an iron fist. No, they got Claude 3. So if you didn't want to use Claude 3 on Bedrock, you can use it on Vertex AI. They said all the same things that Amazon said about it. And all the cool things that were cool about Claude in the original announcement we talked about already and the AWS announcement are also true for Google. So you have choice.
Hey, they're just giving you options of where to run it. It's up to you what your cloud is. They're just giving you a place to run it.
Yeah. Just a home to you know, put up your shingle for your AI workload. You know, you choose a place. Google Cloud Databases stand ready to power your Gen AI apps with new capabilities. At Next 23, they laid out the vision to help developers build enterprise Gen AI applications, including delivering world-class vector capabilities, building strong integration with developer ecosystems, and making it easy to connect to AI inference service. And Google has been hard at work since they made all those promises, are now ready to announce the general availability of AlloyDB AI, an integrated set of capabilities in AlloyDB to easily build enterprise Gen AI apps. AlloyDB AI is available for both the DB and the OmniDB. It is optimized for enterprise Gen AI apps that need real-time and accurate responses, delivers superior performance for transaction, analytical, and vector workloads, runs anywhere, including on-premises and other clouds, enabling customers to modernize and innovate wherever they are. I have a customer quote here from Antoine Moreau, CIO at Regnology. AlloyDB acts as a dynamic vector store, indexing repositories of regulatory guidelines, compliance documents, and historical reporting data to the ground, the chatbot. Compliance analysts and reporting specialists interact with the chatbot in a conversational manner, saving time and addressing diverse regulatory reporting questions.
I'm excited to see this come to fruition, especially all like the AlloyDB stuff that's, you know, kind of coming out. And I think it'll be interesting to see how all these different SQL databases actually leverage, you know, Gen AI capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious to see how this one comes out too. I hope that AlloyDB AI is just something I add to my existing AlloyDB versus having to redeploy a new AlloyDB database. Yeah. I haven't gotten that far through my experimentation yet, but I'm kind of curious for that. Now, you mentioned before the show that you're always amazed at how many announcements AWS has compared to the other providers. Now, That's because AWS only ever talks about one thing in every announcement they do.
Yeah.
Where Google likes to throw a bunch of stuff into here. So this article keeps going and says, vector search, which we talked about here a few times here on the show. They're announcing vector search across Cloud SQL for MySQL, which was Postgres only before. Memory store for Redis and Spanner is all available to you in preview. They also give you Cloud SQL for MySQL supporting both approximate and exact nearest neighbor vector searches, adding to the PG vector capabilities launched last year in Cloud SQL for Postgres, as well as they're giving you additional enhancements to LangChain, which has grown to be one of the most popular open source LLM orchestration frameworks. And in their effort to provide application developers with tools to help them quickly build GenAI apps, Google's open sourcing LangChain integrations for all their Google Cloud databases. And they will support three types of LangChain integrations that include vector store, document loaders, and chat message memory.
All I want to say is this whole announcement makes me feel like I want to just say bingo on the amount of tech buzzwords that they could throw in here. Like, we have Redis, we have we have memory store, we have SQL, we have PG, which for Postgres, there's just everything in one, which goes back to your prior point of Google just throws every announcement into one where, as you were saying, I was like, okay, AWS would either do the Cloud SQL, the memory store for Redis, and the Cloud Spanner. I could see that being one or three for them.
Mm-hmm.
If it's around re:Invent, it probably is three, because they would throw three different slides. Otherwise, I could see them doing it as one.
Yeah.
Plus the whole next one, there's seven announcements in this.
Yeah, the LangChain would definitely be a Jeff Barr blog post.
Yeah.
And then each of the LangChain for vector, LangChain for document loader, LangChain for chat message, that'd be three different announcements in their What's New feed for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, easily. So.
But that's also where I feel like, AWS really does them, very MVP of stuff mm-hmm. when it comes out.
Sometimes.
My favorite, my best example is Image Builder when it first came out. It didn't support KMS. And this is the year after, Warner Vogel was on stage saying, encrypt everything. Everything after that was, extra features. And that's kind of what I feel like they do, where everything else is an add-on, which also makes it impossible to actually know what's actually in AWS times, which is why you listen to the podcast.
Exactly. So let's not ruin the value proposition that we're giving to our listeners. all right. Azure has introduced another Copilot. If you don't know, Copilot is now the catchphrase for everything Microsoft is doing in AI for the consumer side or even enterprise user side. So if you are a Microsoft Copilot for 365 subscriber, you can now add Copilot for Finance. Designed for business functions that extend the normal Copilot for 365 and revolutionizes how finance teams approach their daily work. Finance departments are critical partners in strategic decisions impacting the direction of the company, and 80% of finance leaders and teams face challenges to take on more strategic work outside of the operational portions of their role. However, 62% of the finance professionals say they are stuck in the drudgery of data entry and review cycles. Basically, it supercharges Excel, Outlook, and other widely used productivity apps with workflow and data-specific insights for finance professionals. And Copilot for Finance draws on essential context from your existing financial data sources, including traditional enterprise ERP such as Dynamics and SAP and the Microsoft Graph. Some of the key features of Copilot for Finance are quickly conduct a variance analysis in Excel using natural language prompts to review data sets for anomalies, risks, and unmatched value. This type of analysis helps finance provide strategic insights to business leaders about where it is meeting, exceeding, or failing short of planned financial outcomes. It can simplify your reconciliation process in Excel with automated data structure comparisons and guided troubleshooting to help move from insight to action, which helps ensure the reliability and accuracy of financial records. It can provide a complete summary of relevant customer account details and Outlook, such as balance statements and invoices, to expedite the collections process. And the final feature enables customers to turn raw data in Excel into presentation-ready visuals and reports ready to share across Outlook and Teams. Ooh, that was a lot.
Not gonna lie, I'm kind of looking forward to playing with this, mainly with our Azure Cloud bill.
Yes,
like exactly. I want to see, I already kill Excel and it consumes 10 gigabytes on my Mac, every time I open it with our Cloud bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I have pivot tables and, a bunch of data analysis I do every time about it, but I kind of want to see what Copilot for Finance does with this. So now I need to, go plug this all in and play with it a little bit more. So maybe this will be a Matt does a thing if I get Copilot for work.
Nice. Well, now you don't have to buy 300 users minimum.
It's a big difference.
It's much easier to get Copilot for work and then also potentially add this financial. They didn't have pricing for what the finance stuff costs in addition to the normal Copilot, but I assume it's upcharge. It has to be, right?
It's Microsoft, everything. There's a preview, so.
Yeah, it's a preview, so it's already free for now.
Please know it may take 6 hours after installation for it to appear.
Nice.
I'm definitely not looking at playing with it right now. I don't know what you're talking about, Justin.
Yeah, I 6 hours from now, Matt can tell us how it goes.
Seven. It takes Excel about an hour to open.
Yeah. Okay, so we had a bunch of announcements for support of models, and Microsoft also has a support for a model. Do you have a guess on this one?
Claude 3.
Wrong. Damn it. But I tricked you. It was a trap.
And I have the show notes in front of me.
I know you do. Microsoft and Mistral AI, the recognized leader in generative AI, Mistral AI, and Innovator and Trailblazer, is now available to you on Azure. This is available to you via Azure's cutting-edge AI infrastructure to accelerate the development and deployment of their next-generation large language models, and represents an opportunity for Mistral AI to unlock new commercial opportunities and expand to global markets and foster ongoing research. The Microsoft partnership with Mistral AI is focused on three core areas, including supercomputing infrastructure, which they're providing to Mistral AI, I'm sure, for a hefty sum. Scale to market, ability to leverage these as the models as a service capability. And AI research and development with Microsoft and Mistral AI will explore collaboration around training purpose-specific models for select customers, including European public sector workloads. So Microsoft is not putting all their eggs in the OpenAI basket, which is not a bad choice. But Mistral AI, now available to you on Azure in their model as a service.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Yeah, like we said earlier in that article we talked about earlier, people want options here, you know, as they're kind of finding the exact models that work for them. So if Microsoft just stuck with, you know, one set, it would just kind of burn them in the long run. So I think the whole concept of a model as a service is really going to benefit the consumer a lot more.
For sure. I'm curious if ChatGPT is going to end up available in these things too, or is, you know, because right now it's only available to you through Azure. And I was wondering if that's like a long-term exclusivity contract or like a multi-year exclusivity contract. And so, that, you know, I know they did invest a lot of money into it. So there's probably some contractual obligations, but you know, if all these other models are going to be on everyone else, I would assume that ChatGPT to be competitive is going to have to be on other cloud providers at some point.
Right. Cause otherwise people are just not going to use it in the other models. Because let's say it's a third, a third, a third, you know, of everyone's evenly distributed across the cloud, you know, this will only one third can get access to it, and people are going to start to look at the commonalities across it.
Yeah, I assume it has to branch out. I don't know if it's this year, maybe next year, but it's got
to. Yeah, I assume there has to be enough time for them to get their money back out of it.
Yeah, they get their $10 billion back, which I'm sure they're, you know, we talked about how much money they're making. They're making their money.
They're doing a good job. It was a good investment.
It was a good investment, yeah, for sure. All right, well, that's another fantastic week here in the cloud, Matt. We'll see you next week, hopefully. We'll see if you make it.
Next week, I'm good. Okay. We got to get the rest of the crew here. So.
Yeah, we'll get them all here. We got some show topics that we've been kind of saving for the group. So like, I got to kind of get them all here so we can talk about them. But that's all good. All right, see you next week.
See you, Justin.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. Well, it's already been an AI full show, but in the after show, we can talk about more AI because this is drama. Drama of AI, which is the best type of AI, in my opinion. So you might have noticed that Elon Musk is suing OpenAI and Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, over what Elon says is the betrayal of the ChatGPT maker's founding aims of benefiting humanity rather than pursuing profits. Musk says when he bankrolled OpenAI's creation, he secured an agreement with Altman and Greg Brockman, the president at the time, to keep the AI company as a nonprofit that would develop technology for the benefits of humankind. However, by embracing the close relationship with Microsoft, OpenAI and its top executives have set the pact aflame and are perverting the company's mission. The lawsuit states OpenAI Inc. has been transformed into a closed source de facto subsidiary of the largest technology company in the world, Microsoft. He goes on further to say they are refining the AGI to maximize profits for Microsoft rather than the benefit humanity. You know, it's Elon. What do you think?
I mean, my question is, why is this just coming up now versus, I don't know, 6 months ago when, you know, they said it's only going to be on Microsoft, like, or even, you know, a year ago when the Azure OpenAI resource, you know, whole set was created. So like,
well, things have changed. Grok.ai is out there now, which is Twitter's X's version so of an AI. Yeah. It's doing so well. Yeah. And, you know, potentially Elon may be out there trying to attract talent away from his competitor, OpenAI. And, you know, that it's a talent market out there and a talent war. And if you can, you know, basically undermine the mission that they're saying to the talent they're trying to recruit, might help Elon hire some more people, which, based on how he's treated ex-employees, I don't know that I would ever work for Elon Musk, but, you know, he thinks maybe it's a good strategy. So it's not a good thing. But OpenAI wasn't just going to sit back and let this happen. They basically posted an entire blog post with the intent of getting all of Elon's claims dismissed, as well as they're sharing what they have learned to achieve their mission and ensuring benefits of humanity. And so they break it down to several things. So number one, they realize building an AGI will require far more resources than they initially imagined. And in late 2015, Greg and Sam initially wanted to raise $100 million, and Elon said that they needed a bigger number, as $100 million sounded hopeless against the millions of dollars and billions of dollars that Google was investing. And they should start with a $1 billion funding commitment, and he and Elon would cover whatever they couldn't raise with that $1 billion funding commitment. As they progressed into 2017, they figured out they would need a massive amount of compute, and they would need way more capital to succeed at their mission, and billions of billions of dollars per year, which is far more than they or Elon thought they would be able to raise as a nonprofit. They're going to say, Elon and OpenAI recognize a for-profit entity would be necessary to acquire those resources. And as they discussed with the for-profit entity, Elon wanted to merge OpenAI with Tesla, or he wanted full control. Hey, I've heard this one lately. You heard this one lately?
No, never.
Elon left OpenAI saying there needed to be a relevant competitor to Google DeepMind, that he was going to do it himself, and that he would be supportive of OpenAI finding its own path, but that he thought they had a probability of success of less than zero, and he would build AGI competitor inside of Tesla. Elon pulled his funding in the middle of those discussions, and Reid Hoffman stepped in to bridge the funding gap to cover salaries and operations. So Elon basically thought he gave him the death blow, and Reid Hoffman swooped in as the savior. OpenAI couldn't agree to terms for profit with Elon because they felt it was against the mission for any individual to have absolute control over OpenAI. And Elon sent a message saying he sent an email wishing them the best of luck at finding their path. OpenAI advanced their mission by building a widely available beneficial tools and is making their tools broadly usable in ways that empower people and improve their daily lives, including via open source contributions. They provide free access as well as paid offerings, and the highlight several users of OpenAI assistance for greater good, pointing out Albania using OpenAI tools accelerates EU accessions by 5.5 years. Digital Green is helping boost farmer income in Kenya and India, by dropping the cost of agricultural extension services by 100 times. Lifespan, a health provider in Rhode Island, using GPT-4 to simplify its surgical consent forms from a college level to a sixth grade one. And Iceland is using GPT-4 to preserve the Icelandic language. And they say they always intended the OpenAI to be about the benefits from AI after it's built, not necessarily share the science. And Elon apparently said it in response to that, yup, in the email. And so not only did they write this blog post, but they also published all of the emails that they referenced. So you can go see them and see that Elon was fully in agreement with them at the time. And Elon basically gave them the big fat finger and said, you guys are going to fail. I'm doing it myself. And then ate his crow, you know, ate the crow that he is unwisely killed.
I did not fully read the article beforehand, but I didn't realize that he completely, that they posted all the emails too. I mean, in this type of circumstance.
Yeah, it was like, oh, it's cute. This is a blog post. And then I scroll down like, oh no, they posted the emails.
Yeah, I'm looking through it. It's talking about the Falcon 9 landing for the first time and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
I mean, Elon's done great things. He's an interesting personality. You know, he plays in social media and all these worlds that I probably should play a little bit more in. I just don't, you know, it does good things for him, but like, sometimes, you know, this is why legal departments don't like 10-year-old emails. You know, you put it in writing, you got to expect it to be used for you in the court of law at one point, or the public opinion in this case.
Yeah.
So
I did see there was someone on Twitter, you know, had said the discovery, this is going to be really interesting. And Elon had basically said something like, yes, it is. So I suspect that there may be other emails somewhere in the drether that they didn't dig up for this particular blog post that makes sure the discovery. So I'm sure it's going to be juicy. So you know, we'll keep an eye on this gossip because it's something fun to talk about.
I'm just trying to figure out what he's trying to achieve here. Is it just public opinion? Is he actually trying to sue them? Like,
well, if you think about it, you know, 6 or 9 months ago, he's suing them for money, I think. Right. For violating the terms of the thing. But I mean, if he divested himself from the business, I don't think he has
That's
any
what
say
I'm trying
in
to
it.
Figure out.
I don't quite get that part. But you know, even 6 or 9 months ago, he was encouraging OpenAI to slow down. And we even then, I think, said that, well, that seems like Elon wants to catch up because he knows they're light years ahead of where he wants to be.
Yeah.
But I still have not used X.AI. I've tried most of the other ones because I'm curious about them, but just I don't have any desire to go to X and try those out. I know Jonathan has. Jonathan can tell us how he thinks about it, but I know he's been playing with a little bit more than we have.
I mean, I know I use, you know, ChatGPT. I pay for it. You know, I have some of my, you know, coworkers that don't pay for it and they still get a good value out of it. So like having the free amount, granted it's limited and, you know, raid and crashes because you're on the lower tier, you know, but they do a lot of good and it helps a lot of people. So like, you know, as technology always improves, there's going to be people on both sides of the fence on it. You know, and we jokingly say it's going to take over the world, and it probably will at one point, hopefully after we're all dead.
Hopefully. Yeah. And hopefully after our kids and our kid, you know, our bloodlines have died out too, because, you know, it's going to be rough, I think, in some of these cases.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, I'll see you next week.
See you next week. Thanks, Jason.